Hello and welcome to podcast number 18 from the Self-Publishing Formula.
Two writers, one just starting out, the other a bestseller. Join James Blatch and Mark Dawson and their amazing guests as they discuss how you can make a living telling stories. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello, here we are again with you, and we have a good little mini-series embedded within our podcast for the next three episodes. And we're quite excited about this, Mark, because we talk a lot about novels, we talk a lot about fiction, but we've decided we are going to do a mini-series on non-fiction. Now, before we get properly into talking about non-fiction and why we're doing this, we've got to flag up something that's going to be of very great interest to, I think, novelists as well as non-fiction people, principally probably fiction writers, and that is writing copy for adverts. People have heard the fantastic podcast with Brian Cohen. I said fantastic is my podcast, our podcast, but I think it was fantastic. I learned a lot through Brian. He was brilliant. And you and Brian are doing a specialist webinar live training, which is going to go into a lot more detail about copywriting. And we've got some details about that now, haven't we, Mark? Which we're going to get right.
We will try to get it right. Yeah, it's on Wednesday the 29th of June at 9 p.m. UK time, which is 4 p.m. New York, James?
That is correct. Five hours difference. You are the king of the time zones. Do you even know about the big time zone cock-up you made? You probably don't know. I think John and I hid it from you. We didn't want to dampen your spirits during the launch of the course, but I shall tell you some other time. Okay, let's move on. And just to set this up a little bit before I hear why you think it's so important, I do remember very early on, we had a guest, Joanna Penn, one of our very early guests on the podcast. And I remember we asked her, is it easy to make nonfiction work in the same way it is fiction? And she burst out laughing, saying it's much easier to make nonfiction work. And partly that's because she went on to explain about the range of different things available to you, not just books. But it's a big part of quite a few people we associate with in this area, Mark. It's a big part of their income, nonfiction, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's going to be a big part of plenty of the businesses of our listeners as well. And it's something that I wanted to do for a little while. We've obviously got a lot of experience now in doing this ourselves. We've built a nonfiction business over the course of the last 12 months. So we've learned a lot of things during the course of that time that I think will be helpful for other people. What we're going to do is we're going to look at something that goes beyond just how to sell a nonfiction book. We'll talk about that a little bit too, and the usual things that we talk about with regards to making books visible, building mailing lists, all of that kind of stuff is as relevant to nonfiction books as it is to fiction books and novels and things like that. But what we're going to look at in a bit more detail over the course of the next three episodes is how you can take a nonfiction business or an expertise that you have that would qualify you to write a book on nonfiction, and how you can go beyond that and actually build something a bit more substantial and build a course.
Okay. Yeah. Courses are very hot at the moment. Obviously, people will know that we have a course, which is nonfiction income for our company, as you say. And I suppose a bit of a spoiler ahead of our first guest is that if you've got your nonfiction book, and I noticed a few people signing up for the course recently who have nonfiction books, and what they might be surprised to learn is that it's very possible that the book is not the money-making aspect of their nonfiction income, as you say. It's possibly even a loss leader they give away to turn into income through other streams, such as an online course. And depending on what area of nonfiction you're in, that's something that really can be leveraged. And we've got the perfect opening guest on this, haven't we? Because we've got somebody who was ahead of the curve in many ways and is a great mind on these matters and has a proven track record of building a business out of nonfiction. And he's somebody who's very familiar, I think, to lots of people in SPF, and lots of people who are in our community came through him. And he is a fellow Brit just 20 miles up the road from me, and that is Nick Stevenson.
So Nick's been doing courses for longer than I have. I originally came to know Nick through a nonfiction book that he had out on Supercharging Your Kindle Sales. That was the name of the book. And he saw early on that he could use that as effectively a loss leader, as you say, and an introduction to potential new customers who might like to learn from him. And he turned that book, which is very good, was very successful, but he turned that into an entree for your first 10,000 readers, which is his successful flagship course. And I knew when we looked at this particular subject and how people can make money from nonfiction, I knew one of the people that we needed to speak to was Nick. And fortunately, as you say, he's a good friend of mine now. He's a good friend of yours, James, and the community more widely than that. So he was the perfect first person for us to talk to.
Yeah. And because online courses are turning out to be a very, very good way of creating an income stream for you with your nonfiction knowledge, if you like, we're going to really focus on them. So the next two interviews and that make up parts two and three of this mini series will be with David Siteman Garland, who's a man who understands how to get a course from an idea in your head to something that's going to be a profitable venture for you. And finally, Ankur Nagpal, who's based in New York and owns, as one of the founders of the Teachable platform, which is a platform we use. It's quite widely used in this area as well. So lots of good information, valuable information to come for the nonfiction crowd. And even if you are currently a novelist, you know, David's interview in particular is quite inspirational. He basically says anybody has it in them to create an online course that other people will want to buy. So it's a really good interview to listen to, even if you don't think necessarily it applies to you first up. But as Mark says, let's start closer to home, at least for us here in the United Kingdom, with our friend Nick Stevenson. So Nick Stevenson straddles the twin areas of fiction writing and actual selling. Do you see what I did there? He's the author of the Leopold Blake thrillers, but within our community, perhaps best known for his non-fiction works, which are aimed at helping fellow authors turn their hobby into serious income-generating professions. To that end, he's written books such as Reader Magnets, Get Your Readers to Come to You, Supercharge Your Kindle Sales, and best known of all, perhaps, for his online presence, Your First 10,000 Readers. So our interest today is not just about the advice on selling books, but how Nick has built a small non-fiction empire. So welcome, Emperor Nick.
Yeah, thank you. I like the idea of being an emperor and also straddling stuff.
Yes.
I do love to straddle. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Welcome to the SPF podcast. We should say also, geographically, you and I, at least, are quite close because we're in the same English county of Cambridgeshire.
I think you're basically around the corner. I should have just done this at your house.
Well, you're further north, and obviously we don't go north from here.
Yeah. But, no, you shouldn't. It's grim up north.
Yeah. And Mark's across in the West Country or heading that way. But the magic of electronics, we're all in the same place for this podcast. So, Nick, I know Mark and I have both followed you for some time now. And Mark, when he's having his more honest moments, will say that you are quite an inspiration to him to perhaps open a new avenue of income stream for himself. Is that fair, Mark? I think you were quite inspired by Nick.
Absolutely, yeah. Nick put the course out first of all, and I watched enviously as he put it together and launched it really successfully. And I don't think I would have been interested in doing the Facebook ads course if it wasn't for Nick's example. So that's absolutely true.
So there's a lot of people grateful for that. So Nick, let's start with that then, because this is an area, I mean, people look at you and they look at Mark and think, well, this is very specialist. They've got this very specific talent or knowledge in an area that they can monetize. But actually, you're teaching people who write books that there are ways of making money beyond the book selling itself, aren't you?
Definitely. And I think it's a similar worry a lot of people have when they think about courses in general. They think, oh, you know, I'm not an expert, or I don't have a PhD or a doctorate in something, therefore I can't possibly be a teacher. But in reality, you know, if you've got experience that other people will benefit from, then I think, you know, it's up to you to share that experience with people, if that's what you want to do. And courses is a great way of doing that.
When did you first migrate from writing a novel to writing nonfiction?
Well, it was a couple of years ago when, I mean, I'd written six novels and only really recently figured out how to sell them. Because I think, like a lot of authors, when you write your books, you know, you put so much effort into them and you release them out into the world and nothing much happens. And I think the kind of the common wisdom, and I hesitate to call it wisdom, is that all you need to do is just write more books, constantly write more and more books all the time. And then somehow magic things will happen and you'll become a success. When in reality, it's a lot more difficult than that. And when I figured out that the real key was, instead of building a huge backlist, was focusing more on building up an audience for my existing backlist, then things started to get a lot more successful a lot more quickly. And I'd been documenting everything on this little blog that I had, which I decided to set up right from the get-go, just to kind of write stuff about what was happening. And I was getting more and more followers, and people were asking me to put out a book that would help them do the same thing. So I did. And I wrote, first of all, I wrote a book called Supercharge Your Kindle Sales, which is all about keywords and categories and lovely stuff like that. And then I released a book called Reader Magnets, which is all about how to turn random traffic into email addresses and then follow up with people. And it was great. People loved the books. But I still found that people would download these books and they would email me questions that were specifically answered in the books. Right. Or they'd email me saying, hey, I loved your book. I'm just getting started as an author. How do I sell more copies? It's just like, did you read the book? Yeah. Did you take any of it in? And I realized, I think after maybe 6 months or so of selling these books, and you know, bearing in mind that the books are selling well and that there were affiliate products in there that I was recommending. So I'd say I used a particular email program and I really liked it. I'd send people to a link and I would earn a commission if they bought it. And it was earning a decent income for me, but I was still frustrating because people weren't really investing in the information in there. They were kind of just reading it and then forgetting about it. So I was researching what other companies were doing, and I came across online courses. You know, people selling really in-depth training, way more in-depth and detailed than you could go into in a book. And the people who were, you know, the students who were taking these courses were actually using the information and getting results and just being over the moon about it. And I thought, that's the response that I want from people following my strategies. I want them to actually go out and do it, invest in themselves and go actually, you know, put this into practice and then get results. That's what I want. So I then decided to put together a course, and it all came from there, really.
And why do you think a course gets results or gets people motivated and actionable rather than a book? Because you can put a lot of detail into a book.
You can. And I think there's a few reasons. I mean, with the courses, for a start, they tend to be more expensive. So that kind of immediately disqualifies the people who aren't really serious about it. Because, you know, you've all seen the Udemy courses that are, you know, $5 or free, and they have thousands of students. You know, and very few of them actually do anything with this information. But when you have a premium training, it's more like an education. It's like, you know, when you go to university or you go to college, you're investing a lot of money and a lot of time to learn something specific, you know, and people are happy to do that. But if it's just like a free evening class, people just tend not to really go or get that excited about it. And having that course, having that kind of formal structure where students can come and learn something specific in a lot of detail, you know, often with videos to go along with it as well. And when there's that, I think, you know, the price barrier is helpful as well, because it means that people are physically handing over something. They become more invested in the outcome. They tend to work harder and get better results as a result of it. So that's the main difference, really, is you couldn't charge, you know, more than about $10 for a book. In fact, even that's kind of at the high end. And even at that sort of level, people are still kind of downloading it out of curiosity, reading it, and not doing all that much with it in a lot of cases. So the course structure was perfect.
There's an expression in poker, isn't there, about playing with free money. Nobody plays well with free money. So if you give somebody $1,000 and buy them into a poker tournament, they'll play rubbish. If it's their $1,000, all the focus and attention is there. So I think that sort of backs up the thing that you become invested in something, and that in itself means you're more likely to make the most of it.
Absolutely.
Well, let's just dwell on giving away things for free and people not being invested in it, because conversely, that is actually an important part of the strategy that both you and Mark advocate. And it's a running theme in almost every interview we do in this podcast. And I noticed that your Kindle, is it the Kindle Supercharged book is perma-free now?
Reader magnets is, yeah.
Reader magnets. Okay, yeah. That one is perma-free now. So this is something you use both with your novels and with your nonfiction, that perma-free element.
Definitely. And free is a wonderful way of getting attention and then figuring out who are the people you want to target going forward. So take, for example, with the fiction side of things, you know, I offer a free book as a sort of starter. Mark does as well. And we use that to encourage people to sign up to our mailing list. Okay, but we're still not going to get 100% of people are going to buy something. Right. But it's a way of getting those people through the door and then figuring out who the buyers are. And because something is free, you're going to get a lot of people are going to be interested in downloading it. But not all of them are going to be, you know, prospective buyers. So it's then your job is to follow up and then figure out who your target audience is. And then also to try and convert those people who are on the fence into buyers. So free is a wonderful way of building an audience and getting attention. But to get people results in terms of, you know, the percentage of people who are going to do something with it, it's kind of lacking. So you have to have something else to work towards as well.
It also pre-qualifies people as well. Because let's say if we move out of the kind of thing that we do, Nick, and say, let's say we were doing a book about electrical engineering, so something really esoteric. If you had a free book and someone downloaded it and then they signed up to your list after reading the book, you know from that point they are at the very least interested enough in electrical engineering to download the book. You're getting a different quality of potential customer than would be the case if you just put up an advert to a wide spectrum of people.
Yeah, or offered cash.
Yeah,
that's it. Here's $5 if you sign up to my list, you know, the worst. Yeah. Idea in the universe. It does give you that great way of getting attention from the right people and then further qualifying people as you go.
Can we just drill into a little bit of detail? I'm interested in the post mailing list work that you do to then work out who your customers are going to be. Can you give us one or two tips and tricks at that stage? Once you've gathered the names, how you then do the detailed work afterwards?
Sure. So, I mean, everyone on your mailing list, let's say, you know, there's 100 people on your list. You're going to have maybe 10% of people are going to be buyers already. So they love what you do. Maybe they've read your previous books or seen you speak or whatever. They're going to be the people who are your super fans, right? That 10%. And there's going to be maybe 5, 10%, maybe more, who are never going to buy from you. They just wanted the free book or the free gift and they're not interested in anything else. And, you know, they will eventually either ignore you or unsubscribe. But it's that 80% of other people who are on the fence or not quite decided yet that we then have to kind of target before we offer anything for sale. And this is a big kind of frustration for people is they build up a mailing list and they immediately start sending out sales messages. You know, you've all seen them where you sign up for, you see an advert that says, you know, one weird trick that can lose belly fat in 3 days, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, you saw that one too.
Yeah, exactly. And you maybe sign up for this, then immediately you start getting sales messages through and most people will turn off, but there will be a small percentage of people who will buy it. You know, otherwise, why are they doing it? But the vast majority, that 80%, might buy, but haven't yet decided yet. So it's our job to then follow up with people to try and get those people who are on the fence to buy and commit. So what we do after someone signs up for our email list is we send them more emails. And depending on what it is we're eventually going to try and sell, that's going to have a different focus to it. But the idea is to convert those people who aren't quite sure yet or don't really know who you are, haven't quite built up the trust yet, to build that trust, that brand recognition, and then lead people up the mountain, so to speak, towards the purchase. So we might do that by sending out more free content like blog posts or videos or podcasts or maybe more books. And we do it in such a way that we're kind of telling people that this is what to expect from us. This is the kind of quality I am. And I've got some more cool stuff coming your way soon, but that it's going to be more kind of premium based. So with fiction, this would probably be a good example where you have someone sign up for a free book and then you might offer them teasers and previews of your upcoming launch and then get people ready and excited to buy. And then when launch time comes, you've hopefully converted some of that 80% into the buyers. And that's really what the idea of getting people onto your mailing list is all about, is converting people who have never heard of you into people who love you and want to buy everything you ever put out.
Yeah, I think it's twofold, really. The first thing, as you say, Nick, is you're introducing yourself to people so that they get to trust you and you know, feel that they have a relationship with you. And you're really good in your emails with your personality comes through very strongly in your emails. And that works really well. And the other thing you're trying to do is to demonstrate your bona fides so that if, you know, to go back to my terrible example of electrical engineering, that, you know,
I love that idea. I'm doing it.
Yeah, no, I'm doing it first.
You're so competitive, you two.
But you're just trying to demonstrate that you know what you're talking about. If it's a particular problem that that these people have, you're demonstrating that you have the solution to that problem. And you know, you as you say, you could give
free videos, which is something that we both do, could give out, you know, books or podcasts, all that kind of stuff. But the end game is to demonstrate that you are qualified to offer advice that would help them solve their problems.
Exactly. Even if you're not like a PhD in something, that you're showing people that they can trust you and that you have the expertise in other ways. That's part of converting those people into buyers, definitely.
And we should say there is a little Nick in the environs.
So. He's really, really noisy, isn't he? He's a much smaller, more ginger version of me.
It's very sweet and it's absolutely fine. People will love to hear a family environment. In fact, you know, one of the things that people are working towards when they invest in your course, Nick, and they talk to Mark as well, is this lifestyle that you live as well. Let's talk about that for a second because, you know, obviously you're up north from Cambridgeshire, but it's still a nice place. You work from home, you spend time with your children. Both of you do that. And this is the end goal for a lot of people who will be listening to this podcast.
Definitely. And I think Teddy's handcuffs might be too tight. That's probably why he's screaming.
The radiator starting to come off the wall.
Exactly. It's really kind of rattling the chains there. The lifestyle has been amazing, and it's something that I yearned for so long. I mean, when I finished university, I graduated into the recession, the world's best timing. I think the day I graduated was when they had the news stories of all those guys in front of the banks with their cardboard boxes. And so I was forced to try and find ways of getting work and income through. And I had such a great time just being my own boss and doing various different things. I mean, I made no money whatsoever, just enough to pay rent. But then when I eventually went into a full-time corporate job, I just found it so frustrating because you could never get anything to happen. And you were always kind of constrained by what the business wanted to do. You couldn't experiment, and everything was very slow. And I realized that I wanted to go back to that idea of being my own boss, but preferably one where I could afford to eat as well as get the bus, on a daily basis. So it eventually transitioned into fiction and then nonfiction and then the courses, various other experiments that are going on as well to see what's working. And it's been great fun, but it's allowed me to pick and choose my hours and to work from home or from wherever, really. And the key being that I don't have to be in a specific place at a specific time in order to earn revenue, apart from recording this podcast, of course, which is awesome because it's not based on a US time zone.
So yeah, for once.
Most of mine are at like 9 PM at night.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, you have this system, this funnel, this business that's built up that can earn revenue for you without you having to physically be there to run it. Yeah. And I hate the idea of, people throw the word passive income around a lot, and it's not really passive. You do have to do stuff, but you don't have to do it from 9 till 5, 5 days a week. You can pick and choose how you do it. And that's the real freedom for me, is getting to see my kids grow up and not having to worry about getting into the commute and traffic every morning has just been amazing.
So I was going to say, well, that's one of the key differences there between fiction and nonfiction, is that with nonfiction, using a book as a lead generator and then sending prospective customers to a course, for example, once the course still needs to be updated, you still need to do the promotion and finding new customers and all that kind of stuff, it is less intensive than continuing to write novels. So a key difference is that once the course is done and the funnels are operating, you can take your foot off the gas a little bit. But with fiction, if you want it to be successful, unless you have a breakout hit, you do have to keep producing content.
Especially with publisher deadlines, Mark.
Yes. Tell me about it.
Very much the Tim Ferriss, the 4-hour work week approach. And it's an important point to make. I'm setting out on the fiction writing side of things. And so I'm soaking up everything that I hear from you, Nick, and everyone else. I tell you what's quite difficult is because we all take ourselves seriously as authors, and we all think we've got this novel in us. I used to be a journalist, so I should be able to write. But actually,
well, you make stuff up, don't you?
Yeah, I make stuff up, exactly, for the BBC. Now I do it for myself. The BBC was not privy to that statement. but the important thing is, I am starting to understand this is a commercial venture. This is a business venture. There's going to be a laser focus to it. And a real awakening moment for me actually was sitting down on a sofa with Adam Croft a few weeks back, listening to him, who's written sort of 7-8 books in a row, done a lot of the stuff that we talk about, had made some income. And then he just reversed it. He started marketing Facebook ads that really started working for him, and he reverse engineered his book. He sat down there and he wrote a book that would work for the ads, not the other way around. And that was his golden hello moment to the Tim Ferriss dream. And that's what I'm starting to get around to, this idea. This is not a pretentious thing. I'm not going to win a Booker Prize. I'm not trying to win a Booker Prize, but I am trying to change my life. And I need to have that relentless focus on the commercial aspect of the writing.
Definitely. I think there's still a degree of snobbery in the literary world that we have to try and overcome. And you will see this, you know, any indie authors listening to this, you know, we all know within the indie community, there's snobbery about, you know, people who write how-to books, for example. But if you look outside the indie industry, there's snobbery from the traditionally published people about people writing indie books and selling on Amazon. There's snobbery about snobbery about snobbery. And just like you said, the goal here is to create something, change people's lives and change your own life as well. And we're all kind of in the same boat. And the idea that it's a commercial venture is what we've really got to get behind here and try and let go of these slightly snobby approaches, I think.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit to more detail, because it's the stuff that I'm particularly interested in, and I suspect a lot of the listeners as well. If we go back to the emails, I want to talk to you about two aspects of them. One is frequency and the other is tone. We've spoken to a few people. Marie Force was a really interesting one on tone. She has a very, very friendly, you're part of the team and this is an exciting venture. We're all going on this adventure together. Sort of atmosphere that she creates with her readers, and that works tremendously well for her. I read your emails. You're quite witty. You're quite personable in the way that you write. Quite edgy, I think, as well, in some of the things you do. How much do you think about that tone, and how important is that in terms of getting you to where you need to be with the mailing list?
Well, for me, I find the less I think about tone and the more I just write what comes naturally, the better things go. So, I mean, when I first started out, I was writing extremely generic emails. Like, you could sign up for someone's mailing list and get a dozen emails just like the ones I'd written through, and they were very boring. I mean, they were still effective, but they weren't very interesting. And then I really started working on trying to let go of the idea of offending people. So, you know, not going out of my way to be offensive, but not self-censoring too much. So I would write about maybe I have an opinion on a certain marketing strategy that I've heard about, and I will talk about it and I will tell people what it is that they should be doing instead. I'll write it as though I'm in a conversation, like we're having a conversation right now, and I won't hold back. I'm not going to be releasing like F-bombs or anything, but it's just trying to get you figure out what your own voice is and not restrict yourself too much. And that was a turning point for me, because it became actually quite fun to write the emails. People would reply to them and they get really excited and they'd love them. And then some people would hate them, of course, which is equally amusing. But then I would take screenshots of people sending me hate mail, and I would then put that in an email and explain to people why you can't please everybody. And it's just this idea of having a little bit of fun, trying to be yourself and not trying to make yourself so generic that everybody finds you boring. And this is a big risk for people who are starting out. They will either turn on the sleaze, you know, accidentally usually, because that's what they're used to reading, or they'll write something that's so middle of the road and so bland because they're terrified of somebody unsubscribing that then everybody else just finds it a little bit dull. So for me, having that tone and having your own unique voice makes a really big difference. And you can see that in the amount of interaction that I get in my emails now is a hell of a lot better than it was when I first started out. And that's natural. You know, you learn as you go. But my big tip is just to try and let go of what you think you should be writing and just try to be yourself and try to get your voice to shine through. I mean, you're an author, you're a writer, you know, you should have that ability to do that in your books. Just apply the same process to your emails as well, and it will make a big difference.
And that's, I think, the thing you said there, which is something I struggle with sometimes, is worrying about unsubscribes. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter that much. I mean, I think the thing that bothered me was when I found out what MailChimp's kind of thresholds were.
Yeah.
In terms of abuse reports and unsubscribes. And I was actually catching myself getting the calculator again. Shit, I've had 20 unsubscribes and I sent out 10,000 emails. Does that mean I'm above the threshold or not? And yeah, of course, I wasn't. I'm not even sure how firmly those thresholds were administered. I don't know anyone. I don't think I know anyone who's had their account shut down for those kinds of reasons. But it's that kind of, I think you kind of look at unsubscribes, and that's a pretty visible way to judge whether people have been offended or not by what you've written. And it's very easy to let yourself be bothered by that. And you're right. You just need to let go and almost ignore it. Don't be spammy, obviously, but don't be afraid to be yourself. And if people don't like your message or the way that you speak, then they can unsubscribe. It's probably best that they do, because you're never going to be compatible with them anyway.
Exactly. And I found, you know, when I changed the tone of my emails to be a bit more like I'm talking today, that the unsubscribe rate actually stayed exactly the same. And, you know, every email that I send out, you know, it's the exact same percentage unsubscribe rate. I can't remember what it is, but it's below the danger zone. But I found that while unsubscribe stayed the same, people clicking and replying and opening got a lot higher. So it's been that benefit of trying to let go of the fear a little bit and just be yourself. Definitely helps.
And that's something that comes from fiction as well. I mean, I find that if you enjoy what you're writing, other people will enjoy it more too. So I've tried to write fiction before to market without being in a genre that I particularly enjoy. And that stuff was awful to write. And I imagine it was awful to read.
No, I like your John Milton series.
What's that about F-bombs? You're about to get one. No, it's it's kind of way, way back when I went from traditional publishing to actually continue to try and get a deal, and I wrote something because I thought it would sell a lot, and it was like pulling teeth. And it's similar. I've tried to write emails before and tried to make it sound like someone that isn't me. They're awful. They don't work. They're awful to write. They're probably awful to read, and no one wins. So it's just better. Just be yourself.
So sincerity, and people spot insincerity very quickly, I guess, is the thing. Although for some people, I suppose their voice might not be exactly them. What was it we always used to say on radio, that you sort of have to go away from yourself and then come back, but not all the way back. It's not quite like the way you talk in a pub to somebody. It's somewhere in between being a little bit projecting and a little bit yourself. And I think that's probably the same with your email voice.
Definitely. It's probably not exactly how I talk to my kids, for example, but we have different tones for different circumstances. As long as it's authentic and it's you, then I think that's all that matters.
Okay, let's talk about frequency. You're quite prolific with your emails, I think, Nick. And do you have a formula you follow in terms of frequency, or do you just judge it by responses and what you've got to say?
For nonfiction, for the courses, when someone signs up for the first time, depending on where they've signed up, if they're going through kind of like a pre-launch sequence, for example, where I'm sending them lots of free stuff, getting them excited, then they'll get an email from me every single day. And then once they've gone through that, I might only email them once or twice a week. Depends if I have anything interesting to say. And what I'm actually doing at the moment is building up a backlist, for want of a better word, of emails that have performed well in the past, that are evergreen, so that when people have finished going through a particular sequence, I can move them into what we call an engagement sequence, where I have nothing to sell. I just want to give them valuable stuff. And that will automatically send them an email once a week or twice a week with something really cool that I've written in the past. And this can work amazingly well, because if you email too often for too long, like I wouldn't email someone every day for a year, for example. But if you email too often, you're going to turn people off. And if you don't email enough, people are going to forget about you. And I found this out last year after I launched my course for the first time. It was so exhausting. There was so much work to do afterwards. But I didn't email anyone on my list for like 4 months. And by the time I got back to emailing again, you know, the engagement had just dropped through the floor. So I had to work really hard to try and build that back up again. And now I'm trying to send at least one email a week to people with something useful or inspirational or educational or entertaining or something for them to really keep up with me and the brand. But you know, frequency, there's no hard and fast rules. I mean, for fiction, I think if you tried to email someone twice a week, they'd probably complain. Everyone would probably unsubscribe, because fiction's a bit different. It's a lot broader. With something very specific like electrical engineering or ballet dancing for plumbers, you know, it's a lot more specific. So people tend to have a higher threshold for how much information they get, because it's useful to them. And it all depends on your audience. But, you know, frequency is whatever feels right to you and that you've tested with your audience. I think there's no kind of standard answer for that one.
Plus, relevancy is much easier when you know what people are interested in. So for fiction, for example, I know that people like my books. But there's only so many times I can email and say, writing went well this week.
exactly.
I wrote 10,000 words yesterday. It was great. And that's pretty much the end of the conversation, for me at least. But some other authors will have a different approach to that, but not me. But when you're talking about how do you get more readers? Or for us, how do you use Facebook to sell books? You know, the people are interested in selling books or building their mailing lists, and there will always be something new to say about that. Just a different approach, different strategy that is or isn't working. So you can always say something, and you know that the people are interested in that particular subject. So it's easy to craft those emails, make them interesting, relevant. So it is different between the genres, nonfiction.
Definitely. And fiction readers as well. They might love your books, but may not care the slightest how you wrote them or how many words you've done. So it can be more tricky, which is why for fiction, you know, if I don't have anything to say, I won't say anything. Or I will email out about another book that I've read that isn't mine that I think people will like, you know, but I try not to email too often because like you said, it's not going to be relevant to most people unless it's specifically about a book that I know they like. And if they get those too often, it's going to turn them off.
Yeah. I mean, the way I've got around that problem is on the fiction side of things, I only email when I've got something that they might be interested in reading. So a new book or maybe a deal. Occasionally I might let them know about a deal, but for the kind of the lifestyle stuff. So, you know, the writing process or news or stuff like that, I do a Facebook live video, which is very engaging because you can field questions in real time. People can kind of look in your study whilst you're recording and all that kind of good stuff. So it's great for them. And it's great for me because I don't have to sit down and write a bloody email. So, it's good all around, really. So that's, you know, people are different, but that's working pretty well for me right now.
Okay, well, let's move on a little bit in the time that we've got left, Nick, and talk about the split in your life between these two. I'm interested to know which one you enjoy doing. I mean, do you sometimes kick back and think, if I was just writing novels and had this one focus, I'd be happier, be a clearer life, or vice versa? Is it the nonfiction side?
It comes and goes, really. I think my goal in life is to work on what makes me happy. And I spent 3 years writing nonfiction, writing fiction, and loved every minute of it. But that series and that story came to a close. And I tried writing a new series. I tried a couple more books, got quite a long way through them, and then just decided that the passion wasn't there for that story. So I decided instead of releasing something that I wasn't 100% happy with, that I would focus on something else instead, which was, you know, building up the course, building up the teaching, helping other authors build up their audience as well, was becoming more and more fulfilling for me. Especially as we said earlier, because people are investing in the education, getting results from it. I get emails from people who, you know, literally changed their lives. They've quit their jobs. They've hit the top of bestseller lists. They're finally getting to where they want to be. Is very fulfilling for me. And that's really what kind of drives me to do more on this side. But I also know that and I will go back to fiction, but I will go back when the time is right. And that's an option that is thankfully open to me. So I'm very grateful for that.
Okay. List building, we're going to mention, go back to the beginning part of the conversation when your list was essential with novels. It's absolutely essential. I mean, it's the golden way that people innovate and commercialize on the internet. So talk to us about the difference perhaps between those two areas and how you initially built your list, what techniques you use for the nonfiction side.
Well, the way I built my list, and I still do, is a big chunk of it comes from having free books on Amazon and the other ebook platforms. And as we said earlier, free is a great way of getting attention. And if you're doing something smart with that attention, like converting those viewers into email addresses, then following up with them, that is a real, really great way of earning revenue. And I still use that model today because it just works in the background. And once you set it up, it just continues to work. But I also did some guest posts and guest blogs have been very successful as well. Joint venture partnerships have been very successful. Giveaways have been great. And Facebook ads have been good as well. So there's many, many ways to build an email list. The key is focusing on what's giving you the best bang for your buck.
How much paid advertising do you do?
Not a huge amount at the moment because I'm still getting a lot of people signing up through other revenues, but this is something that I'm working on this year. So at the moment, I might spend a couple of $1,000 a month on Facebook advertising, but the goal is really to sort of 10x that this year. And now that I have the opportunity to focus on that, that's going to be something that I'm going to be looking at very closely because it's a great way of scaling up. Because when you've got perma-free books are great, doing guest posts, guest blogs on popular sites is great. Joint venture partnerships are amazing as well. But if you want to have literally touch of a button control over how much traffic you're getting, Facebook ads are definitely the way forward for that.
In terms of approach, to this, there'll be people listening who have the vestiges of ideas for nonfiction, for building up courses and material, and they've got something to work. There's lots of nuts and bolts. It's very valuable listening to you on this subject, and Mark indeed. But in terms of the kind of attitude and approach that you need, is there any tips you can give people? It can be a bit dispiriting working by yourself, can't it? We all self-doubt quite a lot about this. Is there anything you can talk to people at this stage, at the beginning stage of opening up a nonfiction element to their industry?
Well, there's a lot of things to think about when you're just starting out. And I think you mentioned that idea of getting overwhelmed and feeling a bit lonely is definitely something to work through. But I think one of the ways around that is to objectively test what it is you're planning to do. So if you've got a vague idea for what you want to do in any business, if you can test it and you can prove that the market is there and the desire is there, then that should hopefully give you the confidence to move forward, which is starting to kind of build the framework of what your business is going to look like and how you're going to get people to notice it. And you can use things like a really simple word is a Google keyword analysis, Google Trends, looking on Amazon to see what kind of topics and areas are getting the most attention. And if you have a list already, then sending out surveys is a great way to find out what people are interested in as well. I mean, I did one at the end of last year, which was really helpful for me because I basically redesigned all of my free content around the results of this survey. And this was to authors, you know, asking them, what's your number one struggle? And the results were really quite interesting. So I was expecting people to say like their number one struggle was selling books, or their number one struggle was getting reviews. And while people did say that, overwhelmingly, the number one struggle was building an audience. So my course had been luckily focused on audience building right from the start. But initially, I was gonna do a course that was all about selling, specifically selling, or specifically maybe keyword optimization or something like that. But having done the survey and looked at the actual results, that would have been an absolute disaster. So if you can test your ideas, make sure that people are going to be interested enough in them to pay, then that's a really, really effective way of overcoming that doubt, because you know that objectively the market is there and that all you need to do is have the right product and get it in front of those people. And that really helps you move on to the next stage, which is actually doing the work.
And keep believing it as you go along, because that's the problem. I think people may start out with that enthusiasm. They can do some research and they've got the idea and they think it's going to work. It's 6 weeks down the road. And there was with our business, I'm sure with yours, there's quite a long period before there's any income, before there's any kind of tangible results. Mm. And they're the moments, I think, that you and Mark have been successful in keeping that focus.
It was 4 months for me from the date that I started. Well, this was even longer, actually. It was more like 6 months. But it took me 4 months to build the course and launch it. So all the time I was building this course and I was getting everything ready, there was always this nagging doubt in the back of my mind that, you know, no one's going to be interested, no one's going to want to buy this. But I knew from the emails I was sending out, the research I'd done, the surveys I was doing, that people were very excited about it. So that kept me going and really pushed me to finish it.
And I remember that quite well, because we'd met each other before you started doing the course, and you came over to Salisbury. You drove to Salisbury one day, didn't you, to do a session where we had a chat. That didn't work because
I forgot to turn the microphone on. Yeah,
so we met up again in London to do that again. But this was, you know, you were, there was nothing coming in at that point. It was all basically an investment. So you think even things like fuel or renting a space in London where we could record and the not small matter of the time investment that was required. So you were putting all that up front with just the faith that it would eventually produce something that other people wanted to buy. And, you know, you completely knocked that first launch out of the park. So it paid off, but it was, you know, you had to see that through.
Exactly. It's that belief. And I remember feeling the same belief when I started writing novels as well, because, you know, I had spent hours researching other people, you know, like Joe Conrath and Blake Crouch and others who had kind of started off the Kindle revolution. You know, I knew that theoretically it was possible. So there was no reason why I couldn't do it as well. You know, if someone else can do it, I can do it. I just have to figure out how. And it was the same with courses. You know, I was seeing other people, other businesses releasing courses and doing very well with them. So I knew it was possible. And I knew my audience were interested in it because they were telling me, my research said that the market was there And it was that belief that really pushed me through because, you know, it wasn't an insignificant investment. It was a lot of time and it was a hell of a lot of money to put into something that may have fallen flat on its face. But that belief really did get me through it. And I think authors, I'm sure you felt the same, Mark, when you started off with the John Milton and Isabella Rose series, that belief that it was going to work that pushed you through to get them written. Otherwise, it may never have happened.
Yeah, a bit of that. I mean, I'm always surprised how well it's gone. I don't think I'll ever get over that element of surprise. But I knew I could write good stories, and I knew that people would enjoy reading them. It's just, I think a bit of self-doubt is natural for creative people generally. I still, you know, I still get that today, putting a new book out. I'm still kind of thinking, well, I think this is quite good, but maybe it isn't. And then, you know, you'll get the reviews start coming in, emails, some advanced
reading. That's a great launch email there, by the way, Mark. I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Here's a link.
Yeah, exactly. So no, it's I think that's normal, and self-doubt's it's not a bad thing either. It's good to keep you on your toes, and I don't, arrogance is and overconfidence are not things that we should be looking to cultivate. I think
I still get the fear. You know, I reshot all of my free videos last month and put them out in time for my latest launch, and I was terrified. So I'd taken all this research and I'd got this, you know, I'd been doing filming for a year and I'd kind of got the process nailed and the video looked amazing. The content was structured. It hit all the points I wanted it to hit. It followed the research and I was still terrified that people would hate it. And I was refreshing the Facebook comments because each video has Facebook comments underneath. I was refreshing them every 5 minutes just to see if people hated it. And of course you get one or two people who go, yeah, this is absolute bollocks. But the majority of people really liked it, and the fear was still there. You know, just exactly the same way it was when I would release a new fiction novel, and I knew that it was my best one, but I still thought that people would hate it. You know, that fear will always be there. If you authentically invested something of yourself into a product or a book, you're always going to have that fear. And I think it's a sign that you're doing the right thing.
If I can make an observation as well, I think both of you, and in fact, I include myself here, are quite competitive in life, and I think
I'm
less competitive than you are.
No, I'm less.
In all seriousness, I think leveraging that competitiveness is an important part of driving your business as well. And that's where some of your belief comes from. And you said it yourself, Nick, that you saw other people doing this and you thought, well, I can do that. And actually, it's more than that. You think you can do it better than them. And that's what drives you, I think, and Mark.
I think doing it as best as you can and hitting what you want to hit. I mean, it's a bit of a subjective test as to what's better than something else. But, you know, I will always put out the best quality I can possibly do. And I think the person I'm in competition with the most is me. Mm-hmm. Having looked at what your first 10,000 readers looked like a year ago and what it looks like now, the difference is huge. And I'm always going to be trying to beat myself from what I did last time.
Yeah, I think that's important. And it's not good to, comparisonitis is a dangerous road to go down for whatever we're making. It could be trying to compare I could compare book sales with, somebody I'm writing in a similar genre to, and they might be doing better than I am. And it's quite easy to get discouraged by doing that, especially when you're starting out. So I think it's absolutely right. It's just put out your best stuff, compete with yourself, make sure that what you release tomorrow is better than the stuff you release today, and you'll be on the right path.
Yeah, and be aware of your competitors as well, because it always helps you find focus.
Great. Well, Mark, I'm about to wrap up. So is there anything else that you think we've missed or you'd like to inquire about with Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just frame this a little bit. I mean, what we haven't mentioned it in the interview with Nick yet, but the framework for this series of, I think it'll be three podcasts, is going to be how to make money with nonfiction. So this will be the first of the trilogy, as it were. And, you know, it's kind of using...
Always books, the best one.
Always the best one, yeah, exactly. Or using books as introductions to selling something else. The second one will be with David Siteman Garland, who we've both taken a course that he puts out on building a course. Very meta. And then we're going to speak to Anchor from Teachable, I think, to talk about actually how to technically structure and host the course. But just kind of spinning back a little bit further, we talked about surveys earlier, and I've done that too, with books actually and with nonfiction. And one of the questions I get quite a lot, one of the answers I get when I'm asking, what is your problem? What would you like to solve? Is how to make money with nonfiction. I think there are two ways to do that. You can put out a book in the traditional sense and try and make money off the book. And that is a perfectly valid way of doing things. Obviously, people do that very successfully. And we're going to be talking to Pat Flynn later about his recent launch of his book, Will It Fly, which did really, really well. But the other way, and this I think is the more interesting way, is what you've done, Nick, is using the book as the entree to something else. And that's, I mean, if you were answering that question, would you, I think I know the answer to this, but would you be looking more towards the kind of the traditional sale, or the upsell, or the back end?
Well, the mantra I like to remember is that it takes as much effort to market something that costs $5 as it does for something that costs $5,000, literally. So what we got to do is figure out how much, what your audience size is. So if you're in nonfiction and you're doing something really specific, and there's maybe only 50,000 people in the world interested in it, if your product is $5, you know, that's not going to go very far. But if your product is a lot higher end, the opportunity there is much higher. And this is completely different from fiction, because fiction is so broad that you can get a lot of people onto a mailing list relatively easily with fiction, and then sell them books, and they will buy them by the bucket load. But with nonfiction, the market is generally a lot smaller. So you have to think of other ways to bring in revenue. And because the market's smaller and more defined and more relevant and specific, there it is a lot easier to lead people towards a more premium product. Which is why, I mean, in my opinion, I think it's actually a lot easier to make revenue from nonfiction because of that, the fact that you are much more targeted just on the basis of the fact that you're targeting a specific group of people who want a problem solved or who have a very specific interest. It's a lot easier. And like you mentioned, Pat Flynn, I mean, Pat Flynn had a very successful book release, but you know, he makes 80 grand a month from affiliate hosting fees. Does his book launch come closer? I don't know. I would imagine not. And you know, I think that books are an amazing way of reaching new people, of building an audience, building authority in the nonfiction space. But in terms of the revenue potential, I think there's an opportunity to move people towards other things. Things that will, you know, eventually do better for the customer and the student as well, in my opinion.
And of course, they don't need to be mutually exclusive. I mean, you could very easily build a list, have a course available for them to solve the problem, and then in the future, produce a book and sell the book in a traditional fashion to the existing list that you know is interested.
Exactly. Like Pat has, he has his paid books on Amazon and other stores. He has free books available from his site. He has courses. He has other sites in different topics and niches. He has lots of stuff that he can help people with. So he's got this really diversified portfolio of products. So he's getting a broad kind of spectrum of people signing in one end. And then he's figuring out what they're interested in. And then he's pointing them towards things that he has available. Same with John Lee Dumas as well. He has books out on Amazon, free books as well, using those as audience builders. Then he's got a variety of different products and services available as well through Entrepreneur on Fire. Digital Marketer is another example. James Altucher, there's hundreds of people who are using books as a way to grow their audience and authority, but aren't necessarily making the bulk of their income from book sales. And I think that's perfectly fine. I think that's a great way of running a business, because the book gives people an opportunity to learn something. And then if they want to take it to the next level, that opportunity is there as well, but it's not going to be forced on them.
Nick, it's been very valuable. It's been a pleasure. I could have leant out the window and spoken to you, but we decided to do it this way. Your son has gone quiet, which I'm slightly concerned about, but I'm hoping everything's, you know.
I just locked the cellar.
Yeah. Okay. Good. We should say that you can visit Nick at yourfirst10kreaders.com is the site for the nonfiction stuff. And you've got a good lead magnet there, shall we say, with your free video training. Your books are available at all good booksellers, Amazon.co.uk.
And even some of the terrible ones.
And even some of the bad ones as well. You're a great friend to the SPF podcast. Thank you very much indeed, Nick, for coming along. We will speak to you in the future without doubt. And we will, of course, follow closely the meteoric rise of the Emperor.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Nick Stevenson. So if I was going to be polite, I'd say he's full of wisdom. And if I was going to be rude, I'd say he never shuts up. But he's a good talker, isn't he? He's a great talker.
He knows an awful lot about this and has taught me plenty. Yeah, he was the perfect first person for us to go to when just kind of thinking about general principles about how you can take something that you're good at and then turn it into something other people would be interested in learning about.
And I have to say, the closer I see Nick's business and operation and his approach, the more impressed I am with him. He's a man who's really nailed it, and he works is a bit like us, I hope, quite compassionately as well. It's about the community, not just about, you know, running a profitable business, but at the heart of it is a profitable business, and he's very good at that. Okay, so we are going to move on next week to part two in this mini-series on making money from non-fiction sources, and that's our interview with David Siteman Garland. We hope you can join us for that, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Self-Publishing Formula podcast. Visit us at selfpublishingformula.com for more information, show notes, and links on today's topics. You can also sign up for our free video series on using Facebook ads to grow your mailing list. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. We'll see you next time.